The envoy in North Africa.
With patient, determined, and persevering diplomacy, we can help to make a difference, and that we can assist those in the region achieve the peace and stability that people on all sides long for.
A legacy of French colonialism, religious violence, and international neglect confronts George Mitchell as he begins a trip to North Africa. George Mitchell's Battle of Algiers on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, April 14th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is on maternity leave. Takeaway buddy Todd Zwillick is here to enrich our morning. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we're taking you on a trip to Havana. This is just a virtual trip via The Takeaway, but a new White House move will let more Americans take the real trip. We'll see how Cubans feel about that, plus inside the Department of Interior. The department controls public land with major implications for environment and energy. It's changing big time under President Obama, and we'll explain how that affects you. Those stories and more coming up, but first, a look at these headlines.
More on the Cuba story Todd just mentioned. President Obama is ending restrictions on travel and sending money, but only for Americans with relatives in Cuba. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says it will teach Cubans that democracy is the right path.
In taking these steps to help bridge the gap among divided Cuban families and to promote the increased flow of information and humanitarian items to the Cuban people, President Obama is working to fulfill the goals he identified both during his presidential campaign and since taking office.
We'll talk to Havana right after the headlines, a conversation with our partners at the BBC. Today, the president is focused on the money situation here in the U.S. Later this morning, he gives what the White House calls a major speech on housing, banking, and finance.
Speaking of finance, we'll get two scoops of important economic data in about a half an hour. New numbers on wholesale inflation and also retail sales come out later this morning. We'll have them for you live as we get them. Turning abroad, there's alarming news this morning from two unstable nuclear-powered nations in Asia. First in North Korea, which is now pulling out of six-party nuclear arms talks. It's angry at the UN Security Council, which just condemned North Korea's rocket test. So today, Pyongyang says it's done with those six-party talks. It'll crank up more nuclear facilities it promised to shut down.
So anti-government protest leaders in Thailand are dialing things down. There's still protests, but not as big as the 100,000 that took the streets last week. The S&P rose a quarter of a percentage point. It starts trading today at 8:58. And we are talking about making the world a better place by inventing, actually hacking your dreams into reality. What would you do?
If I was going to invent a device, I think I would invent a pill that would reprogram our bone marrow so that our DNA would not be clipped off every 10 years, so we would not age anywhere near as quickly as we do.
The problem of tinkering in the 21st century. Later on in the program, some hackers who get together and use very high technology tools to make things that come directly out of their dreams. Call us with your dreams. What would you invent if you had the opportunity? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, they've had Viva la Revolucion for about 50 years. Well, now they have Viva la Visiting Family, I guess. President Obama has lifted restrictions on travel for Cuban Americans who want to visit their relatives in Cuba. It's a controversial move, so is any move having to do with Cuba, of course. But at least one group is happy. That's travel agents. Tessie Aral is a Miami-based travel agent. Her company, ABC Charters, is licensed to fly charters and flights to Cuba.
I probably and most likely will have to augment the size of the aircraft that we're using and put that in place to answer all these calls. Right now, I have five phone lines into my business, and a few minutes ago, all five were busy.
It's not just travel. The president has changed the rules on remittances and wants to open up telecommunications between the U.S. and Cuba. Fidel Castro responded last night to the U.S. policy shift. Castro said in a statement that Obama announced the relief of some, quote, hateful restrictions, but he complained that, quote, not a word was said about the harshest measures, the blockade. He's talking about the trade embargo. To hear more on reactions in both Cuba and the U.S., we spoke earlier this morning to BBC correspondent Michael Voss and to Joshua Johnson. He's an anchor and a reporter with WLRN, Miami Herald News. He's been following the story from Miami. When we spoke, I asked Josh to tell us exactly what the Obama policy would change and what it would not change.
Well, the simple answer is that it changes everything. I can give you the more detailed answer in that it basically changes things in four areas. One, it lifts all the restrictions on family visits to Cuba, generally by broadening the definition of what family is. It used to be that only immediate family could go. Now it seems that people who are 3 degrees of separation away from a family member can also go. So now people can bring second cousins to Cuba. That'll probably be important because there are a lot of younger Cubans who may not share the same kind of passion and antipathy for Fidel Castro that their parents or grandparents might.
Right.
And this gives them a chance to say, okay, we're going to take you to the island and show you what we're talking about. We'll show you why we feel the way we feel. It also takes away the restrictions on remittances, the amount of money that family members in the U.S. can send to their relatives in Cuba. It also takes away some of the barriers to telecommunications because currently American companies obviously can't do business with Cuba. This will relieve some of those restrictions so that phone companies, satellite companies, maybe even satellite radio companies can start to do business. And it makes it easier to send gift parcels to Cuba. So humanitarian organizations, especially some in South Florida that really want to help after natural disasters, should have fewer barriers to doing that.
Okay, but there's still a big not change. The trade embargo has not changed.
The trade embargo is still there, exactly. And that has not really appeased, but that's a good thing for some of the harder-line Cuban exile groups and activists who still believe that the best approach to defeating the Castro regime is basically to just pound it into the ground until it disappears.
All right. Michael, can you give us a sense there from Havana? What's the reaction been on the street and the reaction from the halls of the Cuban Politburo, I'll call it?
There's been no official reaction from the halls of the Politburo, if you like. Surprisingly, in some ways, it was reported on state-run television news last night, and usually these sorts of developments sort of get ignored for a few days. But it has been covered. Everybody's aware of it. There's a real buzz around Havana at the moment. Cubans are really quite excited about it. It's not just that they can see their loved ones more often, and the fact, as we've just heard, that they can see not simply their sons or their parents, but actually cousins and second cousins can get together. But it's also by easing the restrictions on sending money home. Remember, this is a country where the average salary is about $20 a month. So this is going to be an economic lifeline for thousands, probably tens of thousands of Cubans. So that's very well received. The other interesting one is President Obama's described Cuban Americans as the best ambassadors for democracy. And that's been one of the arguments as to why he's eased it. And certainly you're hearing similar comments coming from Washington as this bill is presented in Congress to lift the whole travel ban on all Americans coming here.
Michael, let me sort of gin that up a little bit here. I mean, does this constitute on some level, if we are talking about second cousins and, you know, friends and friends of friends almost coming over and visiting, to a kind of a reverse boat lift from the U.S. that will have enormous cultural significance and economic significance that politically the Castro regime will not be able to ignore?
I think it's a two-way process. Yes, you're going to get lots of Cuban Americans coming over here. Wait and see. You know, I think if the full travel ban to be lifted and you start to get American tourists, not just Cuban Americans here, that would be an even bigger cultural exchange, if you like. A lot of Cubans are saying, though, that actually by letting people come here, Cuban Americans will be able to see what it's really like here. I mean, a lot of Cubans argue it's not as bad as it's portrayed in the States, and that, you know, America doesn't tell the truth about Cuba. It's this sort of argument. And so the counter argument is if they come here, they will get a better understanding of what Cuba is like. And this may actually help to foster the Cubans' hope, a policy of engagement rather than this constant colossi of conflict that's been going on since the middle of the Cold War.
All right, Josh, I want to play you a clip from the White House yesterday and get your reaction to it. Listen to this for me. This is Robert Gibbs from the podium in the briefing room yesterday.
All who embrace core democratic values long for a Cuba that respects the basic human, political, and economic rights of all of its citizens. President Obama believes the measure he has taken today will help make that goal a reality.
Josh, what's your reading on the streets of the Cuban American community there in Miami? Do people believe what Gibbs is saying, that this will help make open democracy and political and economic rights a reality?
Some do and some don't. I think it's really important to remember that, like any cultural bloc in the United States, the Cuban American community is not a monolith. And people tend to think of Cuban Americans in terms of what they see on TV when they're in the streets in front of Versailles restaurant, honking their horns and waving flags and yelling and screaming when they think Fidel Castro's dead. That's not everybody. And there's a lot of Cubans who are particularly younger and those who have never lived in Cuba who still want Cuba to be free, but they don't share that kind of hardline policy view that their parents and grandparents may have. I mean, so it's going to vary.
It's kind of
there's some of the hard.
It sounds like what you're saying, Josh, though, is that this is the end of the easy stuff that Barack Obama can do. From here on out, it gets really tough, and that a lot of those people who do have those feelings are going to express them in angry terms.
Well, from here on out, it's kind of push coming to shove mode. I mean, there are some Cuban-American lawmakers like Mario and Lincoln Diaz-Balart, representatives, Senator Mel Martinez, the first Cuban-American to be in the U.S. Senate, who weren't totally crazy about this idea. Martinez was a little more moderate, but the Diaz-Balart brothers are much more hardline. And so it's kind of the nature of the embargo, whether the embargo is still the way to beat back the Castros. And generation to generation, depending on which generation you grew up in, your view is going to change. I mean, remember, this is a policy that was installed by Kennedy in the 60s, lifted the travel restrictions by Carter in the 70s, reinstalled by Reagan in the 80s, modified by Clinton in the 90s, and tightened by George W. Bush in 2000.
Right. And,
so
and,
depending
and the president,
on when you came up, your view is going to be different.
And the president here has given it the old executive order, which means that the political
right.
football, the toss back and forth of this policy is still in play until Congress acts.
Or until Castro dies. And, you know, whichever comes first, who knows what's going to happen next. But I think that most people are at least excited that they'll be able to see their families again, whether or not this is going to do anything for the governmental issue to the Castro brothers, that remains to be seen.
Well,
and the opinions on that are definitely mixed.
Michael, I want to ask you about the Castro brothers and Fidel Castro and Raul Castro. In some ways, the United States has been Fidel's best friend. The relationship was always so bad that he, like a lot of dictators, was able to blame the U.S., as a lot of politicians do, for problems in their own country. And the U.S. was able to blame Castro for a lot of problems in this country. Does this mean that the U.S. has now sort of semi-officially given up on, quote-unquote, regime change in Cuba? Is that a thing of the past?
In terms of regime change, has it given up on trying to change the system here? No. I mean, I think President Obama has made it plain in the past that he sees the trade embargo as a lever, if you like, leverage towards greater moves towards democracy and human rights. He's particularly raised the question of political prisoners. So far, under Raul Castro, there have been some small symbolic social and economic changes, but there are absolutely no signs whatsoever for a move towards greater democracy. Interestingly, on the prisoner issue, from a Cuban perspective, they get very upset and are constantly raising the case of five Cubans who are convicted Cuban spies who are serving very long jail sentences in the United States. And recently, Raul Castro suggested that if it was to open up a dialogue in order to try and get talks with the United States, perhaps they should consider a prisoner swap, these five spies, for the political prisoners in Cuba.
All right. That was our man in Havana, BBC correspondent Michael Voss down in Cuba. You also heard from Joshua Johnson, anchor and reporter with WLRN Miami Herald News. In that interview recorded earlier this morning, they both spoke to us about President Obama's decision to lift longstanding travel restrictions and remittance restrictions on the island nation of Cuba.
Coming up on the program, we'll talk with some hackers who use high technology in kind of garages of their own making to hack their dreams into reality. What's an invention that would make the world better? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Later on in the program, it's not everyone who can pry off the back of their cell phone and hack it into some major new invention that makes them millions. But invention is still possible, and hacking and tinkering is still possible. Go on our website and find out about hacker spaces. We're going to be talking about them a little later on in the program. Places where people can go and use high-tech tools to invent things straight out of their dreams. What would you do if you were in such a place? 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Your inventions to make the world better.
Well, John, it's the Wild West at the Department of the Interior. Ken Salazar used to be a senator, but when he was appointed as Secretary of the Department of Interior, he walked into a thicket of loosened environmental regulations, not to mention some sex and drugs thrown in for good measure. Although most in the Obama administration are looking to turn the page on the legacy of their predecessors in the Bush administration, Ken Salazar may be the first Obama cabinet member to initiate prosecutions of his predecessors. Tim Dickinson is contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, and he has a story in the latest issue looking at the new Department of Interior. Tim, what is Ken Salazar doing differently than the rest of the Obama cabinet?
The news here is that Salazar, unlike many of his colleagues who seem determined to turn the page, has actually referred several people over to the Justice Department for criminal prosecution. He's undergoing a top-to-bottom investigation of what happened over the Bush years, trying to make sure that they know the extent of the mess before they try and clean it up. And so Salazar is a former prosecutor, and his right-hand man is also a former attorney general of Colorado. And so they have referred people not only from the Mineral Management Service, but others. Salazar was fairly circumspect about who had been referred for prosecution, but was clear that this was not limited just to the Mineral Management Service.
Tim, can you first go back a little bit and paint a picture for us what the Interior Department and their collection agency, the MMS, was like under the Bush administration? What were they up to?
Well, the top auditor of the MMS told me that the oil companies were essentially running the show under the Bush years. I mean, in a quieter geopolitical time, we would be talking about the manifold scandals at the Interior Department, like a new Teapot Dome scandal. I mean, these are really a transfer of billions of dollars worth of taxpayer wealth to the oil companies, a very systematic and sort of criminal way that really could have rivaled anything that shook the Warren G. Harding administration. So essentially, The Mineral Management Service is the collection arm of the Interior Department. They take they lease oil and gas holdings to the oil companies,
and they collect the royalties, right? They're supposed to collect the
royalties.
Money. Yeah.
But under the Bush administration, that happened at a much diminished rate. They were always seeking ways to give royalty relief to the oil companies, and so in the most egregious scandal, there had been a mix-up. Congress had wanted to incentivize oil drilling in the deep Gulf waters, and so they had said, we're going to give you royalty relief. We're going to not collect royalties as long as oil stays below $35 a barrel. But what happened under the Clinton administration, the late Clinton administration, was that there had been some contracts that failed to include that kicker, and the Bush administration found out about it, but then they decided to do nothing about it. And once it became public in 2006, thanks to an expose by the New York Times, the Bush administration worked very closely with its allies in Congress to block a congressional fix to this problem. And then to make matters worse, a judge a couple years ago decided that because of the inequities in the way that these contracts had been written, in fact, they would have no royalty collection for all of the deep water drilling in the Gulf.
And then, of course, there's the additional layer of this, which was the personal behavior of employees at the MMS with the people that they were supposed to be regulating. How does that tie into the unpaid royalties?
Well, there was a culture of promiscuity, as the Inspector General of the Interior Department called it, where the people who were supposed to be contracting with the oil companies, it's a bit complicated. This is a separate office in the MMS, which is the Royalty and Kind Office, which is another favor set up for the oil companies in which they were able to pay their royalties not in cash but in crude or in natural gas. But in part of the sweetheart deal, they were then contracted. The federal government paid them to move the oil around. So these people were supposed to be negotiating hard-nosed contracts with the oil companies to get a good deal on moving and processing and refining the oil that was being delivered as a royalty. But instead, the employees were having sex and doing drugs and engaging in a sort of a comic book culture of corruption and promiscuity with these people.
Well, let me ask you, what other cultural shifts can we expect with Salazar at the helm of the Department of Interior looking back on Bush policies? You know, a lot of the people in the environmental community were not excited about his appointment because of his attitudes on drilling and endangered species. Are we looking at a lot of further ideological shifts, do you think, between the Bush and Obama years?
I think that people who are looking for a sea change are going to be disappointed. I think the culture of criminality is clearly going to change, and I think it's that sort of behavior is just not going to be tolerated. But there was a drilling and leasing of land at a rapacious clip under the Bush administration. They leased off of federal lands the size of an area the size of Kentucky, and only half of that has actually been under drilling right now. And there's something like 10,000 drilling permits in the pipeline. So the Obama administration could not drill not lease another acre, and we could have another 6 years of development going on at the pace that it has been going on. But of course, they in fact are aggressively leasing more land to the oil interests. So they've pulled back on some of the most controversial leases around the Utah parks, and Salazar has some specific. There was some oil shale leasing that's been slowed down, stuff that was going on in Colorado that was causing a lot of sturm and drang among Westerners and environmentalists. But he's sort of an old West boot and buckle guy, and so I think there's some proper skepticism about how far he's going to go, and honestly, in this climate where there is so much to do, and so much political capital be spent elsewhere cleaning up other problems, how much attention and how much political capital can Obama really afford to spend on a department that most people don't give a whole lot of thought to?
All right. Thanks, Tim. Tim Dickinson is contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. His story, Obama Sheriff, on Interior Secretary Ken Salazar's effort to prosecute his predecessors in the Bush administration. It's on newsstands now. Femi Okay is right here with the headlines.
At 29 minutes past the hour, North Korea says that it's abandoning negotiations to end its nuclear program following condemnation of its rocket launch last week by the United Nations Security Council. North Korea said it would never take part in the talks again and would restore its disabled nuclear reactor to full working order. Goldman Sachs is pushing to return billions of government loans. The investment bank says it plans to raise $5 billion in stock to help pay back the bailout funds. And the Southeast can expect another round of heavy storms today. Florida officials are watching for signs of flooding in rivers across the panhandle, and it was hit hard yesterday by severe thunderstorms, along with Alabama, Tennessee, Georgia, and Kentucky.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Later in this hour, we're going to find out how you hack your dreams into reality. We have technology hackers that transform whatever they can find into whatever they want. How about a jetpack to get you over traffic?
They can't do a jetpack.
I'd like to. They think they can. They can do a great jetpack.
We'll find
I'd like dinner service I can fit in my pocket and take it wherever I want. Well, we want to hear from you.
It's called an energy bar.
That's not dinner service, John. I want full dinner service, seven plates. But we want to hear from listeners. What still doesn't exist that you need?
Hi, this is Doug from Kenton Falls, New Jersey. I would invent a fail-safe alarm clock. It would be similar to a hand grenade where it had a lever on the side. And to snooze it, you'd have to pick up the alarm clock and hold the lever down. And if you started to doze back off, the alarm clock would vibrate. And if you rolled over on it, well, I guess you really didn't want to get up anyway.
Get the idea?
He's thought this through. I love that.
Get the idea? Take us into the future at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org, John.
Great stuff. More about that coming up. But so joining us now is Bill Zartman, who's a professor emeritus at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Zartman, thanks for joining us.
Happy year.
I wanted to talk to you about something that's an interesting, actually possibly tantalizing sign of, once again, the Obama administration's broad overture to the Islamic world. The former Senator from Maine, George Mitchell, he's now the so-called Middle East envoy appointed by President Obama to seek peace in the Arab-Israeli conflict. But he's now going to the Maghreb in North Africa, a trip to Morocco, Algeria, and also Tunisia. What is specific and unique about the Islamic issues in those countries that might set this trip apart from another sort of garden variety trip to the Middle East to talk to the Palestinians and the Israelis?
Well, it's not specific and unique. It's rather general. That is, this part of the world is part of the Arab world, and it's the extreme west of the Arab world, and it's been very active in the past in the Arab-Israeli dispute. After all, when the PLO left Lebanon, it went to Tunisia. And when before Sadat went to Egypt, went to Jerusalem, his visit was prepared by a meeting of his advisor and Dayan in Morocco. So these are parts of the world that are parts of the Arab world and very active in Arab politics.
Now, in Algeria particularly, the U.S. backed an election there during the Clinton administration, I believe. And then when the Islamists won in Algeria, there was a brutal period that followed when the military took power and an insurgency was destabilizing and produced violence throughout the country. Is George Mitchell, do you think, sending a message specifically to groups inside Algeria?
Well, I think not to groups of that kind, as much as trying to assure that Algeria doesn't enter into a radical opposition, as it has in the past, against moves by moderate Arabs to get the Palestinians to talk to the Israelis. Tunisia and Morocco are moderate supporters of the of a peace process. And Algeria is part of the former rejectionist front, and we want to make sure that it doesn't go off in opposition.
Although, Professor Zartman, in this era when Hamas controls Gaza and the question of Islamist credibility in Gaza, particularly among that group of the Palestinians, is key to entering into any sort of mediation effort. Can the Algerians be helpful here, or are the Moroccans and Tunisians more likely to be helpful? It seems to me, as moderates, they might have some difficulty.
Yes, none of the North African states have special ties with Hamas. And that includes Algeria as well. In fact, the Hamas types, if you will, the terrorists in Algeria, are those very much opposed to the government. So I think Morocco and Algeria would add Arab weight to the process of getting Hamas a little closer to a negotiating position. Algeria can do what it will do what it can, or we will do what it can to make sure that Algeria joins the process.
Is there anything about the timing of this particular trip by George Mitchell? I mean, he already has visited much of the Arab world. Coming at the end, is it important, or coming so early in the Obama administration, does it suggest some different tactic or strategy?
I don't think so. I think we're just trying to touch all the bases, This is the first visit he's made to the Middle East after Netanyahu has been selected, and this is now a closer round to action. Now that all the parties are at least there, and it's an effort on the Arab side, it's continually an effort to get the Palestinian parties together into one operating front. And I think it's just touching the bases and making sure that all the Arabs are in support of this type of activity.
So just touching the bases, Professor, courtesy call, the United States doesn't have anything specific to offer these three countries, I'm thinking Algeria in particular, for their concerted effort on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process at this point?
No, there's nothing specific to offer Algeria. There's an initiative growing, which has the support of Madeleine Albright and General Clark and others, to develop closer economic ties with North Africa and to encourage North Africa to work together itself on economic cooperation, get down the barriers between the countries, and increase their cooperation with the United States and Europe. This has not become official policy yet. It's an initiative that's being pushed, and it may be, I would be a little surprised, but it may be that this has reached action on the part of State Department, and that's being pressed as well.
Well, the potential is there, and any potential influence in Northern Africa will be a part of the mission of George Mitchell. Bill Zartman, Professor Emeritus at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, thanks so much for joining us. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Just picked up in the last couple of minutes some new economic numbers. Wholesale prices fell 1.2% in March, and those prices are the measure of average price of raw goods company used to make products. And retail sales tumbled in March as demand for autos, clothing and furniture all dropped. President Obama may mention both of those numbers when he gives what the White House calls a big economic speech later this morning. It's expected to include words of caution. Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari has signed a bill that officially implements Islamic law in the country's northwest Swat region, and the move comes after Parliament passed a resolution urging the president to do so. In February, he made an agreement with the Taliban to allow Islamic law in exchange for an end to the Taliban insurgency. President Obama is allowing unlimited travel and money transfers by Cuban Americans to family in the island country. And the White House National Security Council says that the president is trying to support the Cuban people. Fidel Castro, former president of Cuba, says that the entire ban for all Americans traveling to Cuba should be dropped.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, everyone. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And it's one of the little details of history that ended the five-day standoff with Somali pirates. It ended on Sunday, and it freed the captain, Richard Phillips, of the ship that was held by those Somali pirates. The most famous captain in the world right now comes from the landlocked state of Vermont, Underhill, Vermont. Captain Phillips lives there with his wife and children. And a spokeswoman for the Maersk shipping firm, which held a news conference yesterday, talked about the reaction of Captain Phillips' wife on hearing his voice for the first time on the phone.
She was laughing while she was on the phone with him. She was saying his trademark sense of humor is still very much intact and he's in great spirits. And if you guys could have seen her light up when she talked to him, it was really remarkable.
Another remarkable detail, she doesn't have a voice anymore, the wife of Richard Phillips. Just one of the details as Vermont prepares to welcome home the most famous captain in the world right now, Steve Zinn, editor and reporter for Vermont Public Radio from the landlocked state of Vermont in Burlington. Steve, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Quickly, how much anticipation is there in this state? And I looked at a map. You can't get there by boat.
No, you can't, unless you have a boat with wheels. There's a lot of anticipation. I think people, even if they didn't know the Phillips directly in Underhill, they knew somebody who knew the family. And for that reason, everybody felt personally affected by last week's ordeal. And while there wasn't a great outpouring of public sentiment about it in town, there were the yellow ribbons, there were the casseroles brought to the old farmhouse where the Phillips lived. So it was clear it was on everybody's mind.
I mean, seafaring isn't necessarily a part of Vermont history, but to be so involved in this story for all 5 days and to have it end in the way that it ended, I gather everyone on the streets of Burlington and around the state has an opinion about this.
Yeah, it's interesting. You never know what your neighbors do for a living, or often you don't. And I think people were really surprised to find that there are people who are working halfway around the world living among them. So we all got a quick education in what the Merchant Marine is about, what the Somali pirates are up to, and, issues that don't normally concern us. Most of us were concerned primarily about where is spring and warmer weather.
Right. Describe Underhill for us and an estimated time of arrival for Captain Phillips, if you know it at this point.
Well, there's very little known at this point about the reunion. You know, even when Andrea Phillips had a voice, she wasn't saying much to the press. I think she was, and the community was kind of overwhelmed to suddenly become the center of international attention. So Andrea Phillips had nothing to say beyond the fact that she had nothing to say and would not speak to the press until after this ordeal was over. And as we discovered yesterday, even when that moment came, her voice wasn't up to it. Underhill is kind of it's not quite the postcard Vermont village. It's a place where the farms are giving way to new homes and the convenience stores are competing with general stores at this point. But it still, has the classic small Vermont town meeting where everybody gets together and argues about the gravel pit. So there is that community feel to it. And for that reason, I think people felt really connected to the Phillips and what was happening to them. At this point, there are no plans for a...
No plans for a parade at this point?
Nothing yet, but we do expect there will be.
Well, normally this time of year, people lose their voice in Vermont by screaming for the Red Sox in the opening week of the baseball season. But Steve Sint, editor and reporter for Vermont Public Radio, talking about the anticipation as people wait to welcome Richard Phillips, if they get the chance, home from his release from Somali captivity, pirate at sea.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Join the thousands of people around the world who have gone to our website, thetakeaway.org, and seen the further adventures of our producer Jim Colgan in places called hacker spaces where people invent their dreams, quite literally. More about that in a moment, but first, headlines from Femi Oke.
Good morning. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. North Korea is pulling out of nuclear arms talks. It's angry at the UN Security Council, which just condemned the North's rocket test. So today, Pyongyang says it's done with the six-country arms talks, and it will restart nuclear facilities it promised to shut down. Thailand's streets are calmer today. Protest leaders called a halt to demonstrations after several died in clashes with government security forces. Demonstrators want the current prime minister to step aside for new elections, and several top opposition leaders are now in police custody. Ousted Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich has a court appointment. Today is his arraignment on federal corruption charges, including the accusation he tried to sell or trade President Obama's former Senate seat. And finally, the music producer Phil Spector got some bad news yesterday.
We, the jury in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Philip Spector, guilty of the crime of second-degree murder of Lana Clarkson.
A Los Angeles jury has found Spector guilty of second-degree murder. He'd been charged with shooting actress Lana Clarkson. That was back in 2003. It was the second trial for Spector. The first ended with a mistrial when the jury couldn't actually agree on a verdict.
What will Court TV do today, actually? Will they just be dark?
Goodness me. Well, I suppose there's always Blagojevich. Do they have the rights for that case? That one's going to run for a while.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So go to your history books. The Wright brothers, you may recall, figured out how to make flying machines by tinkering with state-of-the-art technology in their own bike shop in Dayton, Ohio at around the turn of the 20th century. Jobs and Wozniak, Steve Jobs that is, famously soldered together a personal computer in a Palo Alto living room about a century later. But in our time, technology is less accessible to tinkerers, it seems. Imagine the Wright brothers today. Where would they tinker? Where would they find state-of-the-art technology to mess with and to explore their dreams? Well, they would find it in communities of electronic hackers who get together all over the world in things called hacker spaces and share their gifts, their obsessions, and their exotic tools. So we sent Takeaway producer Jim Colgan out into the hacker community to do some tinkering of his own, and I think it's fair to say that you had the time of your life. You can go to our website, and thousands of people have, to see you having fun with state-of-the-art technology in these great hacker spaces. Explain what you saw and the tools that you witnessed.
Okay, first of all, take a listen to this sound.
Got it.
What do you think it is?
A duck trying to sing?
No. You know, that should be a takeaway question. What is that sound? Actually, what does it really sound like? I mean, it might be obvious.
Maybe a printer, but I kind of know what it is, so.
Yeah, okay, you're just... Well, it is a printer, and most people might have gotten that, but maybe a printer from, like, the 1950s or something. But it's actually a 3D printer. So it's actually a printer of the future. And that was the first thing I saw when I went into this room. There were these hackers playing around with a 3D printer. You know what a 3D printer is, right?
Well, I mean, it's printing objects. It's not printing images on a flat surface. So, I mean, we're not simply talking about making pictures that look more real. We're talking about actually almost doing what a lathe does, machining parts.
Exactly. And for me, it just sounds like something out of Star Trek. This object comes out of something that looks like a printer.
Well, who's using this thing?
Okay, so I asked the guy actually beside him, you know, he was all excited about it, but I asked him, his name was Bree Pettis, and he was a hacker there, and here's what he told me, what people do with 3D printers, which he calls, his one is called a MakerBot. Here he is.
If your friend has one, you can just basically say, hey, Jim, I know you've got a MakerBot. Can you please, you know, make me up some new earrings. My washing machine knob has gone missing. Can you make me up another one?
That's fascinating. But the amazing thing is that if it was the Wright brothers, they could actually design on screen some part and actually make it right there and test it right there. And that's what they're doing in these hacker spaces.
Exactly. Or like Da Vinci, you know, he's famous for having those designs that were never actually made. Maybe he could have made some of them, like a helicopter or whatever he was.
All right.
But so I actually was astounded. I sat there watching this 3D printer. I was in awe. And then out
you're
came,
still in awe.
I'm okay.
So do you actually get some cool thing to put in your hand?
Tell. Well, here's what happened when I saw it.
So what I'm holding in my hand is a beveled gear.
Wow, that came out of it?
Yeah. Zach designed this, and then layer by layer, it built it up until it was a finished object. And we've made two of these so that they can interlock and they're just really satisfying.
Beveled gears, really satisfying. Now, as dorky as this sounds, you're describing really a social networking set of communities, and it's happening all over the world, these hackerspaces where people get together, use exotic tools, and design all kinds of things. I imagine, as a visitor from planet Earth, you know, people had a lot to show you.
They did, and they showed me what they called open source hardware. So we've all heard probably of open source software, but this is open source hardware. They share all this information. And they're all even more enthusiastic than I am right now, if you can believe that. But so I walked over to all the other people who were just dying to show me what they had. And there was one guy, his name was Jean-Pablo Villanueva. He was a member of this group called NYC Resistor. And he showed me what looked like a shoebox that could tell him the weather in 8 cities through music. And here's what he sounded like.
So, for example, let's go to Boston, turn the knob to Boston. Press the button. And that's a little tune, which is the weather forecast for the next week or so.
So now, what does that mean, that tune?
Well, it's sort of low pitch, so it means it's kind of cold. So if you go to Miami, which is warmer, it's going to be a lot higher pitched. See? So Miami's clearly hot and getting hotter.
So a synthesizer in a box getting data from the internet and telling us the weather and he fabricated the whole thing there at, what's it called, Brooklyn Resistor?
It's called NYC Resistor, and it's in downtown Brooklyn, right, in this very sort of gray, ordinary-looking building where they're making these amazing machines.
And in this particular case, we actually don't need this machine, even though it was fun to play.
It was fun to play, and it was, you could tell how much fun it was for him to build, and I'm sure he discovered a lot of things about synthesizers that he never knew before.
What are some others?
Okay, so then I walked up to this girl named Max Whitney, and here's what she told me.
I'm building a clock from outer space for a friend of mine.
A clock from outer space? Mm-hmm. So what do you mean by that?
So it's a clock that counts from a specific time received from outer space.
Oh, like from where?
Pretty much wherever electricity comes from, because as you know, electricity comes from other planets.
So she's taking signals from space, decoding it into some sort of time signature, and then telling time from that.
Who knows?
Why? I mean, it sounds great.
It does sound great, and that was exactly my question. I said, why are you doing this kind of thing? And here's what she said.
It's insanely, awesomely cool, and it's harder than anything else I do, and so it keeps my brain alive. I don't think that we're just doing it for fun. I mean, there's a lot of fun involved, but it's also very much about gaining skills in what's coming next. And so to some extent, it's professional survival. But it's also figuring out what we should each individually be doing next.
So it is kind of like the Wright brothers, but meeting a community. And this is a social phenomenon that goes beyond simply finding ways of making the next big thing.
It does. It was actually a real community. You know, you could tell that they had, you know, this, a lot of their lives were built around this community too, and they sharing information and building things together. And I'm curious. I wonder, did the Wright brothers have that kind of? Did they play like these
right.
guys? That's what
they
must have me thinking now. Yeah.
Well, tell us about this last guy who actually has an interesting to-do list.
Right? Okay, this guy is Nick Bilton, and he's the guy who actually showed me around NYC Resistor, the hackerspace. And he actually works, his day job is working for the New York Times, working at the top of the building, trying to come up with prototypes for the next newspaper, for the newspaper of the future.
That's a hard problem. But he was working on some easier problems there at NYC Resistor.
Exactly. He comes to NYC Resistor to have fun, but that's his day job. But so I asked him about, you know, whether one informs the other. Like, does having fun actually help his day job and help us get a newspaper of the future? And here's what he told me. Now, you have to be just a bit wary. There's a bit of a technical jargon here, which we can explain after.
Right.
So let's take a listen.
I just actually am doing a project right now where we're putting an API into our couch in the living room so that it can detect when people sit down at the couch. And I'm using a new thing called an Ethernet shield on the Arduino, and it couldn't get it to work. And so I, you know, send an email out to our list, and a couple of the guys, you know, gave me the right code and showed me what I was doing wrong and got it up and running pretty quickly. So,
an API with your Arduino with the Ethernet code there, and at least you can call somebody up and get an answer. And I have no idea what he's talking about, but
exactly.
It doesn't matter, right?
No, it doesn't matter. And, you know, APIs, we actually all use them, even if we don't know fully what they are. Like, Google releases their API so that people can build on Google's site. Amazon does it. But anyway.
All right, well, we got to go. But on the website, thousands of people have seen your adventures in NYC Resistor, one hackerspace, and they're happening all over the world. Jim Colgan, our producer, thanks so much.
Yeah, and thanks to Jennifer Hsu, who shot that video. So
yes,
thanks.
Indeed. Take all us
right.
out, Todd.
All right, thanks, John. Thanks, Jim. We want to hear from you now. What still doesn't exist that you need?
A non-painful colorectal exam, like something that they can just look at you and know that you're okay. That would be it for me.
Okay. Thanks for sharing.
Take us into the future at 8778-MYTAKE. Send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, if you missed Jim's story, go to our podcast. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org on iTunes. Here's your takeaway.
I'm John Hockenberry, and you are... What's your name again?
My name's Todd Zwillick. Sorry, that's not
Get
the takeaway.
That right.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Bad Pirate Opera.
We have to continue to be prepared to confront them when they arise, and we have to ensure that those who commit acts of piracy are held accountable for their crimes.
Bad ending for some Somali pirates and a happy ending for rescued Captain Richard Phillips. And also those seafaring people of Vermont.
Moonlight in Vermont.
Who would have thought Captain Phillips goes home to Vermont? You can't get there by boat. Look at a map. We did on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Vermont is landlocked. That's news here on The Takeaway. Good morning. It's Tuesday, April 14th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is on maternity leave, but I'm not all alone. Nope, we got Todd Zwillick here for one more hour.
Good morning, John. Coming up, if you thought debtors' prisons went out of style with Charles Dickens, think again. In our special series, The Color of Money, you'll hear how missing a small payment can get you locked up, even in the 21st century in America. A look inside an alarming new trend, plus we have a conversation with a former sniper and a Navy SEAL for insight into that dramatic end of the pirate hostage standoff. Those stories are coming up, but first these headlines.
Economic news. First, the banks are going to be reporting this week. We'll have more about that in a moment, but it's a surprising result. Retail sales down 1.1%. Forecasters thought spending would rise, but sales were down across the board, from cars to clothes to appliances. It's deflating hopes that the economy's slide is ending. Speaking of deflation, it's happening at the wholesale level. The producer price index is down 1.2%, much lower than economists expected. The PPI is basically how much it costs companies to buy the things they use to make the things they sell us. And remember, lower prices should sound like a good thing, but deflation strangles the economy, actually can hurt us all, lead us to more layoffs. Todd?
Now, numbers like the ones you're talking about, John, they get noticed at the White House. In just a few hours, President Obama makes what the White House calls a major speech on the economy. Expect an overview, kind of where we're at, and also where we would like to be in the talk. Staying with the White House, President Obama is ending restrictions on travel and sending money to Cuba, but only for Americans with relatives there. The White House says this will promote democracy in Cuba. Critics says it will have the opposite effect, helping the Castro regime.
Two quick stories from Asia. Turning to North Korea, it's pulling out of nuclear arms talks, angry at the UN Security Council, which condemned the North's rocket test. Today, Pyongyang says it's done with the so-called six-party arms talks. Moving to Pakistan, a key slice of it is now essentially ruled by Islamic law. The president has signed a deal to allow leaders in the Swat Valley to impose Islamic law. The Taliban is in force there. The S&P rose a quarter of a percentage point yesterday. The Dow begins trading at 80.57, a negative reaction in the futures trading to the PPI and the other inflation numbers. Go to our website to find out how you can hack your dreams into reality. I'm serious. We've got a video about technology hackers who transform whatever they can into whatever they want using exotic, state-of-the-art tools in communities around the world. What would you do if you had anything to make anything? At 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Two deflationary numbers this morning in the economy. Retail sales down more than 1%. Also, the producer price index, the measure of wholesale inflation, down about the same. There's also banks in the news this morning, and there are a lot of details, so get a pen and write this stuff down. Maybe Wells Fargo Bank delivered an extraordinary bit of news when it announced that it would make $3 billion in the latest quarter. It caused the stock market to spike upward. Goldman Sachs reported even larger than expected first quarter earnings yesterday, $1.66 billion. What does it mean for the banks? Did they turn a corner? Joining us now is James Surowiecki. He's here to help us out because he writes the blog The Balance Sheet and is a business columnist for The New Yorker. He joins us from New York to explain in part why there is a prepayment penalty if Goldman Sachs wants to raise money to pay back the federal government. Good morning, James.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk about the various banks that are reporting. I mean, you've got Wells Fargo with a number that I think a lot of people were surprised by, but Wells Fargo is no Citigroup. And Goldman Sachs, of course, which is always believed to be healthier, with a nice profit number reported yesterday. How are those two banks different from the Citicorps and the Bank Americas of the world?
Well, we're going to find out. Citigroup will be reporting earnings later this week. They'll be reporting on Friday, and J.P. Morgan will be reporting on Thursday. Goldman, I think, has always been seen as different. I mean, in the first place, Goldman's business is just very different. It's not a traditional bank. It's officially now considered a bank holding company because it sort of reclassified itself during the crisis last fall. But it obviously is a very different business in terms of what it does. So that was probably a little bit less of a surprise. And I think the other thing about Goldman is that historically, at least over the course of this crisis and over the housing bubble, it ventured much less into subprime and sort of these, you know, very bad loans that a lot of these banks had. So that was maybe a little bit less of a surprise. Wells Fargo, which technically didn't report last week, it actually pre-announced. I think it's officially going to release its numbers maybe next week or in a couple of weeks. That was a little more shocking. It basically said that it was going to make about, as you said, about $3 billion. People had, you know, Wells Fargo traditionally had been thought to have a better book. In other words, it had been considered to have made fewer bad loans. Nonetheless, you know, most of its business or a good chunk of its business is in California, which is really the epicenter of the housing bubble. And as a result, you know, people, I think, were expecting pretty dismal numbers. It also had acquired Wachovia last year as part of kind of the breakdown of the banking system. Wells Fargo came in and picked up Wachovia. Wachovia had made a lot of really bad ventures into subprime. So, you know,
well, let me stop you right there on the Wachovia thing, because it seems to me that the Wells Fargo issue is maybe distinct, way distinct from Goldman Sachs, and is possibly indicative of what's going to be happening with some of these other banks. In theory, it looks like Wells Fargo bought Wachovia at a absolute bottom of the market, and things have changed in the last few months. I'm wondering if they're, you know, kind of buying low and selling high at this point. Suddenly, assets that seemed absolutely worthless are now worth something, and it reflects a kind of bounce that is coming off the bottom.
Well, that's kind of the hopeful take on things, the optimistic take. That's probably somewhat close to what I think happened. I mean, what Wells did when they bought Wachovia was they wrote down most of what they bought. So, in other words, they took or accounted for a lot of the losses that they anticipated that Wachovia was going to have on its loans right away. So Wells's numbers last quarter were absolutely, completely dismal. And as you said, there's some sign of it's not exactly health in the housing market, but there's more activity. Obviously, we know that mortgage rates are incredibly low. People are starting to venture back. Housing sales are still down, you know, from where they were, say, a year ago and so on. But quarter over quarter, month over month, you are starting to see maybe slight signs that there's a bottoming. And as a result, I think you're right. You're starting to see that some of those assets that Wells had maybe written down to whatever, a zero or 20 cents, are maybe worth slightly more. More important,
or a lot more.
Yeah. And more importantly, they're doing a lot of new – they said they were doing a lot of new business. The exact numbers are a little foggy, but they said, you know, they might do as much as $190 billion in new mortgages, or that may also include refinances over this quarter and I think the next one. And the key thing to understand about the banks right now, it's a little technical, but it's really important to understand. Banks are able to borrow money very, very cheaply. So they basically are paying almost nothing for the money they borrow. And then they're lending that money out to us. And the rates they're lending the money out have come down quite a bit. I mean, mortgage rates.
But they're still high. For people that don't have perfect credit, they're like in the 6, 7, 8.
Right, exactly. So the margins, the profit margins for these banks have really widened quite a bit. And as a result, if they can just sort of keep steady on their old loans, they're making a lot of money on their new loans.
Hey, James, can you help me understand something?
Sure.
What does profitability mean for an industry that's in the middle of a $700 billion bailout from the taxpayers and another $1.5 trillion from the Fed? Is this profitability with an asterisk? What does this really mean?
Well, it's an open question. I mean, if you think about these particular banks, the big banks that we're talking about, so Wells, J.P. Morgan, you know, and so on, they have, you know, Wells, I think, has gotten basically $25 billion from the government. So, yeah, profitability with an asterisk, but I think the reality is that with big banks, if you – when you – or in a situation like we're in now, where interest rates are very low, as long as they can kind of stay in business, they are going to make quite a bit of money over time. And while it's profitability with an asterisk, the one thing to remember is every dollar these banks earn right now is, for the most part, a dollar that we are not going to have to put into them if we say we're to take them over.
But are we going to make any money on this deal? I mean, Goldman wants to put $5 billion, you know, in equity markets to pay back the TARP. The feds actually don't want that to happen because it makes the other banks look bad. But, hey, I'm a taxpayer out here. I'd love to get a little piece of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, Goldman, you know, Goldman, as you said, has to raise this money. They announced plans that they want to raise money from private shareholders in order to then pay it back. That was part of the deal when they took the TARP money in the fall, that was the only way they would be able to pay it back. But the government is hesitant to do that because they don't want some banks to look good and others to look bad.
Sounds like the government's listening on your phone, James.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I just wonder what that was. Yeah. But the thing I would say is that in terms of kind of the taxpayers' return, I don't expect that we're going to make back all of the money we put into these banks. I mean, as you know, it isn't just these banks. I mean, something like 400 or 350 banks have gotten some money. And I don't expect to get that all back. But I do think that if the banks return to some measure of health or profitability, that in the long run, you know, we'll get a good chunk of that money back. And, you know, I mean, I was thinking about Citigroup. I mean, the government now owns something crazy like 35% of Citigroup, or will once everything's done. You know, Citigroup stock was up like 25% yesterday. So the government made like $1 billion on its investment in Citigroup yesterday. So, you know,
and they bought it $1 a share.
Yeah.
Right? They got it good.
Exactly. So we do have an interest in that sense, an economic interest, aside from the broader, you know, we want the banking system to be healthy. We do have some interest in these banks doing, you know, reasonably well.
So James Surowiecki, of course, he writes the balance sheet, the business columnist for The New Yorker. I mean, your column has always been, you know, well read in The New Yorker, but did you know you're actually speaking at the NYU Skirball Center on May 5th? I mean, this is a sold out rock star event. Did you ever believe that would be possible?
Well, it's definitely something. You know, we had our first conference last year, and this will be the second one. And I think it is a reflection of the fact that, obviously, I mean, what can I say? In the last couple of years, you know, this kind of subject has really become sort of essential, I think, to the way people are thinking about the world. And, you know, it's front page. I mean, it seems like every day the New York Times has some big business story on the front page. So I think things have really changed, you know, not really for the best, to be honest. But I think it is something that is basically on everybody's mind.
But because people are suddenly more knowledgeable about, like, the arcane sort of details of the banking industry, does that help us, insulate us from the surprise and the sense of shock? You know, should things turn around in the next, you know, 2-3 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think the more interesting question is, you know, will we stay interested? And I do think that over the years, say over the last decade, the last 20 years, there's been more of that. People managing their own money, you know, all of this, you know, you're hoping people are getting more informed. I think the important thing would be if, when this all ends, let's hope it does end, that, you know, people remain to some degree or another engaged and interested in what happens, because, you know, it is very arcane and it's very easy once we get into the questions of what we're going to be getting into, like how do we regulate the financial system?
Well, he's hoping for a long-term focus on the part of Americans broadly. My guest, James Surowiecki, writes the blog The Balance Sheet and is a business columnist for The New Yorker. Thanks so much, James.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's a story that continues to electrify the world. A five-day dramatic standoff, a daring rescue, the end of the hostage situation for Captain Richard Phillips on the Maersk, Alabama, a U.S. cargo ship, and the nerves of steel of the snipers themselves who ended it all by killing three of the pirates. Here's President Obama in a low-key sort of nerves of steel way himself talking about what pirates can expect from the U.S. military in the future.
We have to continue to be prepared to confront them when they arise. And we have to ensure that those who commit acts of piracy are held accountable for their crimes.
A military official from the Washington Post spoke to the Washington Post on a condition of anonymity, summed up the mission a little differently. He said, three pirates, three rounds, three dead bodies. Joining us now is Brian Adams, a former Army sniper and a full-time student at Rutgers University. He has a Purple Heart and is a member of Veterans for Education. William Brown also joins us from Rutgers. He's a former Navy SEAL in Iraq. Brian Adams, William Brown, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me today.
It's a pleasure.
Let's talk for a moment about this, you know, elite of the elite. There are the Navy SEALs, all right, William Brown?
Right.
They're an elite. But then you have the snipers, Brian Adams. They're also an elite of an elite. How far does the culture of snipers go back in the military, and how selective a group are snipers within the Navy SEALs?
It's a very elite group. It actually goes back from the Revolutionary War times. You need skilled sharpshooters to take precision shots. And in the SEAL teams, it's known for building a mental capacity, the ability to make strategic shots under stressful situations, and the ability to make those shots with precision.
Now, Brian, this military official in the Washington Post said, you think of rough seas, 75, 80 feet away and under darkness, and they got them, describing the successful shots that were fired that took out these pirates. How does the technology assist a sniper in today's military, and how much of it is just pure psychology?
Well, both factors play heavily into that shot. As you know, we have one of the most advanced militaries in the world, and we're also some of the most highly trained soldiers, most professional soldiers in the world. And I have no doubt that those snipers have probably been shooting every day for the past couple of years. And, you know, they take their jobs very seriously. They're very focused individuals. And, with the assistance of the high technology, it can make a shot like that easier.
William Brown, what are the rules of engagement for snipers? Are they different from other military who are, you know, holding the trigger and on the front lines?
Each operation has different ROEs, and it depends on the priority of the mission. A mission like this had the highest priority all the way up to the highest levels of government. I'm sure that the team selected some of the best snipers on the planet, and one of the training, it develops you to be an independent thinker. Each SEAL's gear is figured differently. If you look at conventional forces, their gear is standard, and each team member, special ops operator, has a responsibility, and their training and the filtering process, the rigorous of that training, is a testament to the responsibility and respect that the military and our government allows these special operators to conduct their operations.
But you can't be on an open line to the White House in something like this. At a certain point, Brian Adams, you have to make the call on your own, right?
Yeah, the way rules of engagement work is, you know, you get the orders from your commander. And if they give you the go-ahead, then you just wait for the opportunity. You just have to be patient and focused, and then when the opportunity arises, then you'll take your shot.
Does that mean if it all goes wrong, it's all on you?
Pretty much, yeah.
Brian, does it mean in this case that the time between go ahead and snipers firing shots was probably a matter of seconds or minutes or hours? Do we know if decisions were made in a split-second way and they took advantage of an opportunity, or whether they had standing orders, let's say, for an hour or two to take a shot if they could?
It could be any amount of time. It could be a few seconds, or it could be a few hours. But, I mean, the snipers are trained to wait that long to stay ready and focused, because they might have given the order not knowing, you know, how things were going to play out. And then just when they saw their opportunity, they hopped on it.
Now, William Brown, based on your experience as a Navy SEAL, and I know now that you're, you know, running for office in New Jersey's 8th Assembly District, you're entering politics now. I mean, politics is a much messier world than the kind of cut and dry mission guidelines of something like this. You gonna be good with that?
I look at it like this. I'm not the typical candidate. I come from a blue collar, a military background. And I think actually that's an advantage to me, because I think a majority of voters are becoming disenfranchised with politics as usual. So I look at it like this. No one can shoot at me.
Right. Yeah. You'll, for about 5 minutes, you'll have that view. So, William Brown, thanks so much for being with us. We don't want to give the suggestion that we are extolling or celebrating the death and, you know, what happened. We're certainly happy for the rescue of Captain Phillips. Brian Adams, did somebody come to you and say, we'd like you to be a sniper, young man?
No, there's actually a tryout process. There's a lot of screening processes just to get you into that tryout. You know, you have to have a high PT score. You have to have a high score on your ASVAB.
What's ASVAB?
It's your acceptance test into the military. It determines, you know, what jobs you'll be good at. And then you go through a screening process. And then you start training. And then once you're trained by your unit, then they send you to sniper school, which is a 6-week school.
Past that, and you wait for the call. Well, Brian Adams, thanks so much for being with us. Brian Adams is a former Army sniper and a full-time student at Rutgers University. William Brown, a former Navy SEAL in Iraq, both joined us from southern New Jersey. And now, Femi Oke has some headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Some new government numbers on the economy are out this morning. Retail sales fell 1.1% last month. And that was because of a big drop in auto sales that's led the slump, and those sales in clothing, furniture and appliance stores were all down as well. The producer price index, or PPI, dropped sharply last month too. It's down 1.2%. And also looking at projected regular grey gas will average around about $2.23 per gallon throughout the summer months. This news comes from a new report from the Department of Energy. And that really is a bargain compared to last summer. Do you remember last summer when gas topped $4? Which
I'm
is pretty amazing.
It.
Yes. And one more story for you, a sad one at that. Harry Callis, who's the legendary baseball announcer for the Philadelphia Phillies, he died yesterday. That's a look at some of the big stories making news for you this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Markets reacting in the early going to an unexpected drop in wholesale prices by 1.2%. The Dow opens and immediately drops below 8,000. We'll have to see. It's early yet. So you can go to our website to find out how you can hack your dreams into reality at the at places called Hacker Spaces. You can actually invent your dreams, and we invited you to do the same.
I need a sunscreen pill. Especially one that would be suitable for children. I got a 7-year-old. Sunscreen season's coming, and neither one of us are up for another summer of squirting sunscreen all over him while he well, he fights me.
Take us into the future. Invent your way there at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Okay, well, John, here's a mystery for you. Who took the gay-themed literature off of Amazon.com? That was actually the debate yesterday when the blogosphere and the Twittersphere erupted in rage. It's when it suddenly became a lot harder to find gay-oriented books on one of the world's biggest retail sites. The company said it was just trying to limit adult material and that gay literature was inadvertently swept up. So is Amazon anti-gay or just clumsy? Well, it's not completely clear, and the murkiness of the company's convoluted ranking and searching and tagging algorithms isn't making it any clearer. Well, to help us sort it out is Baratunde Thurston. He's a prolific blogger and a Twitterer. You can see his work at baratunde.com, and he's one of the many people opining about this on yesterday on the internet. Baratunde, thanks for being here with us in the studio.
Thanks so much for having me. Good morning.
Well, good morning. What do we know about what happened? Did Amazon really ban gay-themed books from its website?
Well, the first thing I know is that you just used the word Twittersphere. So you're going to lose a couple points just for that.
Sorry.
That sounded kind of questionable.
It was really on the edge of sanctioned behavior. As far as what we know about Amazon, not much. The first response was from a low-level customer sales rep who said, we're blocking adult themes book. We had a gay author Sunday morning who found that his work was less discoverable on the Amazon system. Then later, the company came out more officially and said it was a glitch. Glitch is obviously a word with big, fat quotation marks around it. And meanwhile, people have been building lists of books that they were also unable to find. Finally, last night, the company said that it was a cataloging error that affected more than just gay and lesbian books. Sexuality books, 57,000 titles in total is what they claim.
Right. Okay. Of course, this morning when we searched gay and lesbian or homosexual on Amazon, we got, 84,000 or 87,000 hits. So they've run and fixed this pretty quickly, right?
It seems like they fixed it. I mean, what has actually happened is really confusing. I was trying to spend money on Amazon, which is the way I found it. I was looking to rent a movie on demand, and I tweeted it because I tweet everything. And somebody said, hey, do you know that Amazon's blocking gay and lesbian themed books? And they use this tag, Amazon fail. After digging more, you find all this controversy going on. And the search results for homosexuality at the time were pretty much about how to not be gay. It's sort of like how to get over your homosexuality, how to avoid having a gay child. So there were all this seeming politics in the search results.
Right, so that doesn't go to glitch that swept up homosexuality or gay in some larger search term of sexuality or adult themes. It sounds like they delineated between the positive sides of being gay or lesbian,
right,
and wanting to not be gay or looking for advice on not to be.
And there were also other questionable items that were just fine. They maintained their sales rank. And what was really affected was the number that's called sales rank, which allows a book or item to appear in a top-selling list, makes searching more simple and more accessible.
Which is a trade secret of Amazon, by the way.
And the way that PageRank for Google was also
right,
a trade secret.
Now, is the story here possibly about the they? I mean, who is the they that's controlling this? I mean, you describe possibly a story that companies or portals, and Amazon really is a sales portal for so many products, are in a constant battle with people who are trying to manipulate the inner data and project political agendas, maybe just a prank, and that this is a more or less 24/7 operation to prevent this from happening.
It absolutely is. I mean, the company has millions of products, millions of customers, billions of dollars in transactions, and trillions of clicks, I'm sure, in any given year. So it's hard to police a system like that. When you have kind of Raising Your Gay Kids books is banned as adult, where Ron Jeremy's memoirs or Ann Coulter's books are not touched at all, like, it feels like there's some politics going on. A hacker actually took credit for what happened, and there's some possibility, but I'm not qualified to say how plausible it is, and some people have challenged whether or not he's responsible. What's clear is that trust has somewhat been violated in this case. You guys remember Walmart in 2006 when you searched for Planet of the Apes? You got Dr. King's biography. Yeah. And there was a big sort of fluff up about that. In October, you searched for a terrorist costume and Barack Obama's face came up on Amazon, and it was all because of user-generated tags that really threw the system off. So maybe that's what happened.
So it is feasible that user-generated tags, somebody with some kind of anti-gay agenda or social agenda, could have manipulated this on Amazon. Because I asked the question because their explanation of glitch, whether it was somebody with an agenda or just a stupid move inside the company, glitch doesn't really cover it either way.
Glitch covers their butt temporarily. You have to remember this did happen on Easter Sunday, and which is a very convenient time for someone who wants to, you know, cause some trouble to have it happen when, you know, responsiveness is going to be a bit slower. So it's a bit tricky to understand exactly what may have happened. But with so many products, Amazon does rely on user ratings and rankings and tagging. And if they have an automated system that has a threshold where if something is hit as adult X percent of times or X number of times, someone could write a script that maybe takes advantage of that. The challenge is...
But, of course, they're writing it all the time. People are trying to get first in marketing terms.
That's
People are already trying to manipulate the marketing. So the politics is just one other step.
Yeah, and you have so many... Amazon, like you said, is a sales portal. It's a big gateway, and it is a statement unto itself. It's a very powerful ecosystem which represents what we value in society. And something slash somebody said, I don't value this type of literature, therefore... that's going to be removed. It's unlikely that the company made that decision on its own, but they certainly seem like they were victimized by it. And more importantly, their explanation is what's been lacking. So whether or not they did it on purpose or they were the victim of an attack or a concerted group of people came together, what folks want when this happens is an apology. That's clear.
Right. The strangest part about this isn't so much that it happened. It's sort of the ham-handed reaction that Amazon had.
Yeah, they said
ham-fisted. They're now saying that it's a cataloging error rather than a glitch.
Right.
So the language is
very
evolving.
Rumsfeldian.
Yes,
there are books that we know and books that we don't know. And all of a sudden, so there's been no explanation or complete fix. And I think what we really need for all these online systems to work, you need trust. You need Google to be trustworthy. You need Wikipedia to be trustworthy. You need a society like this to be trustworthy. And Amazon lost a lot of trust this weekend, not only in what happened, but really in how they reacted to it, which has been very, as they've said, ham-fisted and continues to be right now.
All right. Baratunde Thurston is a writer and a blogger. You can check him out at baratunde.com. I apologize for saying Twittersphere. Oops. I just said it again. Baratunde, thanks for joining us. Femi Okeye is here with headlines.
Thank you. At 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama gives what the White House is calling a big economic speech later this morning. He has cheered recent positive economic signs, but his speech today is expected to include words of caution. Meanwhile, it's being reported by AP, Associated Press, that the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke has said that there are tentative signs that the recession may be easing. Goldman Sachs announced yesterday that it turned a profit of more than $1.6 billion in the first quarter of this year. The investment bank also says it plans to raise $5 billion in stock to help pay back government bailout funds. And I have to do this story, otherwise Todd will never forgive me. Bo, America's next first dog, will officially meet the American press today. The six-month-old puppy is a black and white Portuguese water dog. That's just for you, Todd.
Because I'm all about the dog, right?
You love the dogs.
Oh, God. Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. North Korea says it's pulling out of international talks on ending its nuclear program. We're here with the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus. He's joining us from London. Jonathan?
Yes, hi.
Hi, thanks for being with us. Well, it seems like North Korea makes these threats on a fairly regular basis. Is this different?
Well, I think a lot of people are interpreting this as an effort to get the new Obama administration's attention, obviously at a time when Washington is setting out its stall. The problem is that the regime in North Korea is so unpredictable, so difficult, that there is always the danger of things spiraling off into a direction that really we wouldn't want it to be going. Now, on the face of things, the North Koreans are saying they're not going to talk anymore in this six-party framework. They're not going to abide by the various steps they took to disable some of their nuclear facilities. Obviously, we're going to have to see what they actually do. But I think the fear is that, it doesn't take much to push this off into a direction that would make things very, very difficult for all of the countries in the region. And so there's going to be huge diplomatic pressure, particularly from Russia, but especially from the Chinese, to try and get the North Koreans to rethink and come back to the negotiating table.
Okay, just to recap real quick, this is a cascading effect after the North Koreans launched a missile, they say a rocket trying to put a satellite into orbit, sanctions from the UN Security Council unanimously condemning it. This was North Korea's reaction to that. So, but they used very strong language. They say never. They used the word they will never participate in the six-party talks.
Well, they did indeed.
Yeah.
And in fact, one has to say it was a rather tepid response from the UN Security Council. This wasn't a resolution because the Russians and the Chinese balked at that. This was a statement from the Security Council. Council that has much less weight, if you like. The sanctions that are talked about are probably no more than enforcing the previous sanctions that were in place. And frankly, they haven't done a lot of good. The only countries that really matter in terms of sanctions are South Korea and, of course, crucially, China. Now, we were at this point some years ago. If you think back in 1994, the Americans and the North Koreans agreed a framework under which North Korea would give up its nuclear program and it would get power-generating reactors to provide electricity. That program lasted for about 10 years until the Americans decided that they thought that North Korea behind their backs had been pursuing other nuclear weapons-related activities, and it was the six-party framework that took over from there. So, in a sense, we've already been back to the drawing board once. It's possible that we may have to go back to the drawing board again this time, but it's very hard to see, you know, what possible avenue or approach there can be to this problem of North Korea than the kind of six-party framework bringing in all of the key regional players, particularly China. And I think even if this were to drift into the sand this time around, I'm not sure that everything is lost.
Jonathan, let's just look at that for a moment. The six-party talks were a Bush administration initiative. It came up at the campaign that Barack Obama, on some level, prefers a kind of bilateral approach to something like this. Is this possibly an opening or no?
Well, possibly, but with the sort of sounds coming from North Korea, from Pyongyang, I think that's unlikely. I think the important thing is that they have to have the Chinese and other key players on board, and that is what makes the framework, the six-party framework, so attractive. Within that, there is the possibility of direct talks. There have been low-level direct talks in the past, but I think getting as many of the key players on board together is still going to be crucial for carrying forward any solution.
All right, the BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus joining us from London talking about North Korea's response to the UN statement on nuclear talks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Femi Okeh was in the hosting chair for the last couple of days. It was a real pleasure, but now she's back in the news chair. Hi, Femi.
That's okay, I'll recover. 7 to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. You see, I can't even tell the time now. I've been away so much. Good morning, everybody. Here are some news headlines for you. We have fresh economic news out this morning. First up, retail sales. They're down 1.1%, and sales were down right across the board from cars to clothes to appliances. And the other new report shows wholesale deflation, and the producer price index is down 1.2%. The PPI is basically how much it costs companies to buy the stuff they want to sell to us. Now, a select group of Americans now has unlimited travel privileges to Cuba. President Obama is lifting restrictions on Cuban Americans with relatives on the communist island, and they can now make unlimited family trips and money transfers to Cuba. Fidel Castro is speaking out. He wants the U.S. to lift the larger trade and travel embargo. President Obama says he's got no plans to go that far. And Michael Jackson is auctioning off the contents of his Neverland mansion. They are now over 1,000 items of his belongings on sale, including the crystal glove worn in the Billie Jean video and his crystal-covered tube socks. Probably set you back around about $10,000. If you're interested, you can check out the bidding online. That's a look at stories making news this morning, Todd.
The tube socks come in pairs or one by one, like the gloves?
You get two pairs of socks, but one crystal glove.
But only one glove. I'll keep that in mind when I make my bid. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Mo Money, Mo Problems. It's the Grammy-nominated second single, 10th track on the first disc of Notorious B.I.G.'s album Life After Death. Well, we might amend that these days to less money, big problems. And what we're talking about this morning is the color of money. Posing a question, is there a color to this recession? Is it affecting people in different ways, depending upon their ethnicity and where they are in the culture? Stephen Bright joins us. He's the president and senior counsel of the Southern Center for Human Rights. He also teaches at Yale and Georgetown Law School. And we wanted to ask him this morning about the idea that for some people in the United States, the consequences of the recession are draconian, and that the identifiers racially and culturally may be very, very relevant here, particularly in the sense that it is possible in America to actually go to prison for not paying your bills. Stephen Bright, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Is there a debtor's prison, in a sense, in America that you can actually serve time for missing payments or not being able to come up with money that you allegedly owe?
Well, there's no question about it. And with regard to people who are fined for what would be minor infractions, one of the high costs of being poor is that not only do you have to pay a fine, for example, and then a number of surcharges and add-ons and other things, which a person of means would just simply pay and leave the courthouse, a person who cannot afford to pay that will be given the opportunity to pay in installments, which sounds okay so far, but then they'll be required to pay $40 a month while they pay those installments to a private probation company, so they're going to be paying a very high interest rate. And at any time they can't make those payments, they're going to be subject to arrest and incarceration for their inability to make the payments.
So in a sense, their payment program amounts to a kind of parole.
Well, that's right. And we're talking about people here who really are on the margins, people who are barely struggling to make it, who may have a job that doesn't have any benefits, who may just barely be making it with regard to their rent, and who, if they are taken off the streets and put in jail, may lose their home, may lose their job, their ability to support their children. Everything just sort of starts collapsing around them as a result of that. So instead of sort of trying to help these people get back on their feet and become useful and productive citizens or keep them moving in that direction, the efforts of a lot of these courts to sort of be cash cows for communities is very counterproductive because what we're doing is it's very, very difficult for a lot of people to make these payments. They're already struggling to put food on the table.
Well, I want to talk about the lack of redemptive opportunities in these various processes, and it does vary state by state. But does this manifest itself unfairly and predominantly among communities of color, Stephen Bright?
Well, it does because they're predominantly the people who are in the criminal justice system. I mean, way, way disproportionately. To where they are in the population. If you go down to the courthouse, what you'll see is overwhelmingly that the people being processed through the criminal courts, the poor people that are being processed for petty crimes up to more serious crimes, are overwhelmingly going to be people of color. And, of course, that doesn't match the 13% that they constitute as members of the population.
Stephen Bright, what exactly are the rules here? We were led to believe that debtors' prisons in the Dickensian sense, in the Charles Dickens sense, are no longer legal. But is this sort of a backdoor way these fines and failure to pay fines can land you in jail with warrants? Is this just a backdoor into debtors' prison, or is it more formalized than that?
Well, it's not really a back door. It's a pretty straight up thing. It's just that nobody really calls it what it is. People are also in prison for failure to make their child support payments. But it's basically, if you can come up with the money, you can get out. And it puts a lot of pressure on families to try to come up with the money so that people can get out. But an awful lot of people can't.
And there's a fundamental, I don't know what we would call it, ambiguity here. I mean, for most criminal offenses, you pay your so-called debt to society, and your time in prison accounts for something. You leave,
right.
and you know, that's over with. But in this particular
right.
case, your time doesn't necessarily pay the bill.
No, your time is really the enforcement mechanism to, I mean, the courts are a collection agency, basically, that have a power that other collection agencies don't have. If you owe the finance company or you buy a car and you've bought it on payments, they don't have the ability to throw you in jail. They may be able to sue you and get a judgment against you and go through that process. But the courts, if you fail to make one payment, you've got payments, let's say, if by the time you're you add on all these things and you owe something like $1,800, you know, you're going to be making a payment of $480 a month. If you can't make one of those payments, even if you're late on making it, you may go to jail for 30 days.
Right. So to put a finer point on it, though, these are people who are in jail convicted of no crime, in other words. I mean, just to make sure that's clear.
Well, they were convicted of a crime originally. That's what the fine is for. But what they're going to jail for is failure to pay the fine.
Are there people in this situation where they just assume, because of the complexities and the agony of dealing with this economic crisis right now, they would just say, fine, if that'll end this, I'll go to jail?
Well, that's true. And, of course, the thing, the point to notice here is that the person who can afford to pay pays right up front and never worries about this, never pays these $40 a month probation fees, and never worries about going to jail. That person deals with it the first time the fine's imposed, and that it's over for that person. This is, as I said, this is part of the high cost of being poor, because the poor person ends up paying, you know, this probation fee, $40 a month. If you spread out the payments over a year, that's $480 right. that you pay if you're poor that you wouldn't pay if you weren't poor.
The cost of being poor, and part of our Color of Money segment, as you described, Stephen Bright is the president and senior counsel of the Southern Center for Human Rights. He also teaches at Yale and Georgetown Law School, speaking about essentially a debtor's prison in the United States. Thanks so much.
All right. If you missed anything on the show today, go and subscribe to our podcast at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, we've got a video on our site about technology hackers who transform whatever they can find into whatever they want. So we're asking you to dream big just like them. Some of you are already designing the future.
This is Carla Gonzalez calling from Detroit, Michigan. The College for Creative Studies, or the school where I work in Detroit, currently uses MakerBots, if you would want to call them that, to train our product design and automotive and transportation design students, as well as our craft students. We are designing jewelry, cars, all kinds of things using these 3D printers, and they are amazing.
Tell us what you want. Go to our website at thetakeaway.org.
And there are, in fact, two ways of getting to Vermont by boat. Yes, you can go by the St. Lawrence Seaway or by the Hudson River on the Champlain Canal. I said it's a landlocked state. Who knew?
All right.
I didn't.
You can't get there in a Maersk container ship, however, in a boat that's probably not worth hijacking anyway.
Well, anyway, the takeaway is all about proper geography, and we didn't have it this morning. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.